Hello and welcome to the Securities Compliance Podcast presented by the National Society of Compliance Professionals, where it is our mission to help you put compliance in context. I'm your host, Patrick Hayes, partner at the Calfee Law Firm, and on today's show, we're going to be discussing how you can build a culture of compliance inside your firm and what it takes to build out an effective compliance team. In our headline section, the SEC Investor Advisory Committee considered draft recommendations on mandatory arbitration clauses and the expansion of retail investor access to alternative assets, among a few other items. And a duly registered firm settled SEC charges for failing to timely investigate and report suspicious transactions to FinCEN. And finally, we'll wrap up today's show with another installment of What's On My Mind, where an old quote from Winnie the Pooh might just give us a little bit of guidance on the best thing we can do for our friends and loved ones during the holidays and these cold winter months. As we move into the headlines section, the SEC Investor Advisory Committee considered draft recommendations on mandatory arbitration clauses, the expansion of retail investor access to alternative assets, and the regulation of, quote, finfluencers. Chair Gary Gensler and Commissioners Mark Ueda and Hester Peirce framed the discussion of these issues under the following headings. First, mandatory arbitration clauses in investment advisors' agreements. The IAC, as it's also known, is considering recommendations on the potential development of a standardized disclosure framework to ensure investors fully understand the terms of these clauses, including costs and the process for resolving disputes. Commissioner Peirce highlighted a recent report by the SEC's Office of the Investor Advocate, which raised concerns about disclosure inconsistencies and the potential for arbitration to become a prohibitory process. She emphasized that it is essential for the commission to maintain a balance between investor protection and freedom of contract. Another item that was addressed by the IAC included retail access to alternative assets. The IAC also considered recommendations on increasing retail investor access to alternative investments, such as private equity and venture capital, and calls for further exploration into how registered funds, such as ETFs and closed-end funds, can be used to offer retail investors a way to diversify their portfolios with alternative assets. Mr. Ueda noted the growing interest in private markets driven by many factors, including the rise of unicorn companies and the increasing costs and complexities of going public. Both Mr. Gensler and Mr. Ueda emphasized that it is critical for the SEC to facilitate innovation while protecting investors. They discussed how registered funds could help provide professional guidance for retail investors seeking exposure to private markets. Finally, regarding the regulation of finfluencers on social media, the IAC also considered recommendations on regulating these types of finfluencers or individuals who use social media to share financial advice. The draft recommendations would require finfluencers to disclose their regulatory status, education, and business experience, which could serve as a safeguard for investors. Ms. Peirce acknowledged the risks associated with unqualified advice, but raised concerns about the scope and potential First Amendment implications of such recommendations. She also questioned whether the SEC should regulate all financial content on social media or focus only on content that is clearly linked to investment advisors. She warned that the SEC must be careful not to overreach and infringe on free speech rights, as many social media users share their opinions without the intent to advise or solicit investments. Moving to our next headline, a duly registered firm recently settled SEC charges for failing to timely investigate and report suspicious transactions to FinCEN. According to the order, the firm, one, failed to promptly conduct reviews of certain potentially suspicious activity, two, took months or years to complete regulator and law enforcement requests to investigate suspicious activity, and three, violated its own policies and procedures on financial reporting, record keeping, and record retention, and the filing of suspicious activity reports, or SARs. The SEC highlighted an example of the late filing of reports on 68 suspicious transactions totaling nearly $2 billion related to an entity that the regulator warned about 2 years earlier. The SEC also found inadequate staffing for the firm's anti-money laundering monitoring group, which resulted in, quote, aged cases, end quote, where potentially suspicious transactions were left unreviewed for extended periods. The SEC concluded that the firm violated the Securities and Exchange Act, Section 17A, and 17A8, and to help settle the charges, the firm agreed to a $4 million civil penalty, a censure, and a cease and desist from future violations. The SEC acknowledged, the SEC did acknowledge that the firm did take some remedial steps, including increasing the staffing, the establishment of a dedicated investigative teams, and the adoption of enhanced policies for SAR-related inquiries. I highlight this particular order because I think, especially in light of the new FinCEN rule, which we've talked about on the podcast earlier this year, I think we can certainly expect there to be similar types of these cases, or these might be a bit of a harbinger of the kinds of cases that we might see in the future once the compliant date with the once the compliance date for those new FinCEN rules comes into effect. As we move into the interview section of today's show, we're going to be talking about a topic that may not be as technical in nature, but that I think is certainly as important as many of the technical requirements that our compliance professionals and other legal practitioners working in the securities compliance space would certainly is integral to their to running their compliance program. And that's building a culture of compliance and really building our compliance teams. And to help guide us through this incredibly important topic, we are very pleased to welcome in Norm Askinas, who is the Chief Compliance Officer for Robinhood Markets. In his role as CCO, Norm oversees compliance for all of Robinhood's businesses. He joined Robinhood in 2020, initially as the CCO for Robinhood Financial, which was their retail broker-dealer. Before that, Norm actually spent 17 years with Fidelity Investments in a variety of different compliance leadership roles, most recently as the Senior Vice President and Head of Compliance for Fidelity Institutional and Fidelity Brokerage Technology, as well as CCO for National Financial Services and Fidelity Distribution Company. Norm has had a distinguished career across a wide array of different roles in the compliance space and has really in-depth experience in this area when it comes to not only building a culture of compliance inside the institution and the firm itself, but certainly what it takes to attract and to bring in the right pieces, the right fit when you're thinking about building out your compliance team. Norm, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the show today. We really look forward to hearing about your experience.
Appreciate you having me, Patrick, and I'm armed with coffee. I wonder if you could call this compliance coffee in context, because coffee caffeine is essential for all compliance officers, that, what you do.
That's good. That's good. Maybe we can even start, it sounds like we've got a good spinoff show here, like comedians in cars or with coffee. We'll do a compliance officers with coffee. I like it. But no, thank you so much, Norm, for coming on the show today. And I think one of the things that you and I have chatted about related to this topic in the past, and I think even you got to talk a little bit about this at the NSCP National Conference back in October. But I would love to get your thoughts, right? Given all of the different roles you've had throughout your career and in working with the C-suite folks at a variety of different firms, when you hear the term a culture of compliance, what are some of the things that you think about when you hear that term culture of compliance? And what are some of the things that you can do? Or maybe actually, here's how I'll frame it. When you think about a culture of compliance, what are the first things that come to mind?
Overused term. That's one thing that comes to mind first, Patrick. But it's also really the heart of it. Culture of compliance isn't, I start with what it isn't. It isn't just about what do the compliance people do. It's really about the firm itself. It's what's the beating heart of the firm? Does the firm believe compliance is important to be a good citizen, to follow the rules, to do the right thing by customers, investors, and the markets? That's at its root, what kind of embodies that for me is, what does leadership think? Is leadership committed to it? Is compliance at the table? Are they part of the conversation? Or is it, let's go talk to compliance after a decision is made and after everything's happened? Is it infused in everything? Do employees mention compliance when compliance isn't in the room? That's always a plus. Does somebody say, hey, did anyone think to call Patrick? He should be at this meeting. I mean, those are a few things. And I think I'd add as well, again, another overused term is tone from the top. But, you know, would it walking the walk, talking the talk? I can throw out all these hackneyed phrases, Patrick, but really what it's about is, what is the firm doing? Who's involved in the decisions? Who's involved in crafting how the firm approaches things? And is your program an afterthought, or is your program part of what the firm does, just like marketing is, just like finance is, just like product is?
Yeah, that's really good. And I think that's a really good place for us to start. I think that's a perfect foundation for us to build from in hearing you talk and thinking about certainly those conversations that your business constituents, those subdivisions inside your firms or other folks inside your firms may be having. I think frequently what I love that you articulated there is, are they thinking about or talking about compliance even when you're not in the room? and I think you can, I think that's so important. I love the way that you frame that, because that, for those firms where that is happening, I think that happens because the compliance officers inside of that firm have done a good job of building a rapport and a working relationship and a collaborative relationship with those business units, so that rather than the thought being, hey, let's try to get this thing passed through without running it by compliance, right? Which is not where we want them to land. They're thinking of it of, hey, we want to get from A to B, but we want to make sure we're doing it in a compliant way. Has anybody reached out to Norm? Has anybody reached out to Patrick?
That's critical, Patrick. I even had one of those examples a few weeks ago where somebody I didn't know reached out to me via Slack and said, hey, so-and-so, senior executive, thought I should reach out to you because we're thinking about doing A. And he said, you should talk to Norm and compliance first to see what they think and how to get it done. That's what I want to have happen. And it's not about me. It's about somebody else thought of compliance when we weren't there. That's really what it's about. We actually want to be talked about. We're not in the room, which is the opposite of high school.
Exactly. Well, so let's stay on that. I mean, because I do think how you've just set that up for us, I think, is going to be super helpful to help also guide the rest of our conversation. And maybe another point that I would say is that concept of having a culture of compliance, which I also like the fact that it is certainly a phrase that is used, sometimes overused, but how do you go about building it? That seems like one of these things, and maybe that's part of why it gets so overused, because people almost want to will it into existence, right? Versus actually being able to really effectively build it. So when you think about building a culture of compliance, what are the ways that you think you can best do that?
Well, I think, first of all, you got to start at the top. I mean, again, depending on the size of your firm, the top could be it could be in a 5-person shop. Let's recognize we have a lot of listeners, but whatever it is, the leadership of your firm has to understand and agree compliance is important. You want to make it, if your firm has values or a mission, maybe the word compliance isn't in there, but the concept is in there. And for us, we have a value at Robinhood called safety first. That's one of our core values that we communicate publicly. Does the company have something akin to that? That's really your starting point. Do you have a culture where there's thoughtful changes? Are you thinking about customer trust? You know, again, I'm thinking of compliance with a lowercase c, Patrick, which is, are you recognizing you're in a highly regulated business? Do you realize that you owe a duty to be, quote, compliant to customers, investors, and the markets? Because that's your employees, by the way, because they want your firm to be around for the long haul. So you've got a number of constituents. And I do think it's from that standpoint, start from what is best to do the right thing. It's hard, and then build out everything from there. And if you're getting that, then you start getting into all the regulatory and Department of Justice expectations and the like. But you got to start from there, Patrick.
Yeah, that's really helpful. And one of the things that you talked about inside of your kind of response there that I really like, and I think are certain themes that I think you could start to see across when you're in the building stage of that, because there's the leadership commitment, which you certainly talked about. Again, you need to start at the top, and you need to be able to have folks at the firm that are invested in that. Even the story that you just relayed a moment ago does that, certainly training and education. But a couple of things that I really liked that you talked about, that at least I see implied in that response, are you've got employer and employee kind of accountability, right? And so there's this phrase out there that we have used frequently in some of the trainings that we've done during like an annual compliance training or something like that, which is that there are certain individuals at the firm that may be focused on compliance, and that's part of their primary role, but everybody at the firm practices compliance, right? Or in the case of what you're describing, everyone contributes to the culture of compliance. Is that certainly something that you would say can also add to, again, when you're thinking about building that culture of compliance across the firm, where everybody essentially has a stake in contributing to that culture?
Yeah, I would say that's an easy yes, Patrick. It's compliance just has to be part of what you do, just like anything else. I mean, you have to think of it as it's table stakes. Like if individuals there are not held accountable, if they don't hold each other accountable, if the firm isn't holding them accountable for meeting these regulatory expectations, the cultural expectations, where does it fit in the mission? Are you getting support? Do you have some middle manager somewhere when an employee says, wait a minute, I don't think we should be doing that. The policy says X. Does that middle manager say, I don't care what the policy says. No one from compliance is here. Go ahead and steam ahead. I mean, those little moments, you want to try to not have those moments happen. That's a way to describe it, Patrick. And it's hire the right people, make them have the right point of view. And every firm, just like in any industry or anywhere, there are some people who make bad choices, either intentionally or unintentionally. The goal is to make sure they know when they're making a bad choice. So you train, training and education, as you mentioned, and make sure when they make bad choices, they're not able to do that again, and other people see that that's not acceptable at the company. That's a very simplistic way of looking at it, Patrick, but that's how I'd think about it.
Yeah, no, I agree that certainly it's straightforward, but I also would agree with how you've described it there and how critically important that is to be able to. And we see that frequently, and I would say certainly there's all different kinds of obviously ways to approach building a culture of compliance inside the firm. But one of the things that we found most important, and it tracks it exactly with what you just described, is that when people start to engage in violative conduct, no matter whether it's a person who's in an entry-level position to a person who manages other people to a senior leader, there's got to be a certain level of accountability there in order for that culture of compliance really to persist in a positive way.
Yeah, and Patrick, maybe I'll share a brief story as well to talk about matching up what is the accountability, what is your culture looking for? I shared this at the NSCB conference because it literally happened to me the day before, but on a flight, I was sitting next to somebody and struck up a conversation eventually after we both did our heads down in the laptop thing, and came to learn this is somebody who'd started their own business later in life, a candy store, and it was based upon recipes from their grandmother that they had learned making candy and chocolates and all that with their grandmother as a child, and that was a family thing, started the business. And I asked them, I was about to go do this talk about compliance programs and hiring, I said, How do you make hiring decisions for your store? It's a small shop or shed too. How do you make decisions? And she said, well, I test for their commitment to family because our culture is about family. And she told this story about, ask them questions. What kind of relationship do they have with their parents? How often do they talk to their siblings or their grandparents or their cousins? What does Sunday dinner mean to them? If they live near family, testing for all those things to really see is family first for them, because the culture for them was it's about a family because this is a family shop based on family recipes. That's the DNA. Every company's got a different DNA and you have to test for that DNA. And that will help you from a compliance perspective because you're going to match up people to that.
Yeah, that is a great anecdote and certainly one that I love. One of the things that has been a common thread throughout all of the podcasts that we've done on the show is really that there are a lot of things not in compliance or that in other fields outside of compliance, but that share the same kind of lessons that we can learn that can be helpful in building our compliance program or in some particular technical thing that we're doing as it relates to our compliance program. And that story about, again, this woman who is running her own candy shop and what she's looking for in the culture that she's trying to build there. Again, what we can glean from that, I think, is just fantastic. But you touched on something there that's probably a good natural segue into talking about, okay, so as you're thinking about hiring your team, right, and in that particular story with the candy shop owner, she's looking at family and what does family mean to her and the kinds of communication that she's keeping up with regard to her employees are keeping up with their families. For you, and when you're thinking about sourcing and recruiting and hiring and building out your compliance team, what are some of the questions that you're asking? What are some of the key things that you're looking at there?
Well, I think you're a couple steps down the recruiting process, but yeah, if you're asking questions, certainly you're starting with the technical expertise. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you're looking for somebody who does surveillance on municipal securities, they have to know a great deal about that space to start, if that's what you want them to do. So certainly you're testing for that. You are certainly looking for culture fits. Again, another overused phrase, but if your firm is the type of firm that seeks to get alignment from everybody, and it's a firm where they don't want somebody to present a solution, they want to have conversations with everybody who might be a stakeholder, get them all on the same page, and then have a final discussion, you need to find people who can do that kind of thing. If it's a firm that's more entrepreneurial, where it's, we want you to go solve the problems and see how people react, you have to try to ask questions to glean what that is. So it does start from what is your firm looking for after you hit the technical expertise. And then you also certainly want to ask, how do they fit into your overall compliance program and team? Complementary skill sets are helpful. Like you want technical expertise, but in some cases it's, am I hiring somebody to do this job in front of them for the next 2 or 3 years? Or am I hiring somebody who I think can do much more than this or different things? Am I hiring I'll use the phrase, a pocket knife, somebody who's got a multiplicity of things they can do, and I see them doing a number of different things? Those are things you've got to think about as you're doing the hiring. And then I'd add each, if you're hiring at scale, which I've done several times, each person you hire might change how you think about the next person that you're hiring. Because you say, okay, this person's got these extra things in their experience. They've got these arrows in their quill there. I might need somebody else with different arrows for the next role because I have filled this other piece. And the last thing I'd add that's probably worth its own podcast is making sure you're hiring with an eye on diversity of thought, diversity of background, diversity from a demographic perspective, like all elements of diversity, because you don't want, I shouldn't say this, don't want, from my perspective and my experience, most programs don't benefit from having everybody the same for a variety of reasons. People should reflect your business model, should reflect your customers, should reflect society, should reflect the industry, and should reflect having a multiplicity of points of view at the table so you don't end up missing things.
I think you've touched on a couple items there that I would really, really love to dig into and that I think are emblematic of really strong leadership. One of the things that you touched on that absolutely resonates with me, and it actually relates a little bit too to the diversity that you talked about at the end of your response there. But I've worked previously with firms and compliance departments where the CCO of that firm more or less expected everybody else to fall in line. And they weren't necessarily interested in hearing differing opinions or in hearing other people's approaches to certain things. They felt very strongly that they knew the best path forward and they weren't necessarily in getting outside thoughts or perspectives on it. What I love about what you articulated there in a couple of different ways, but it's like, number one, having the ability to recognize, like, there are certain things that you might be really good at, that you're really strong at, but bringing in someone that has their own unique set of skills and talents and experiences that maybe you don't have isn't necessarily going to detract at all from your ability to serve as the leader of that group, but rather you can build up, right, the entire team. And the ultimate quality of the program that you're running and for the firm more broadly is going to benefit so much from having that additional skill set, right? It's in like whereas I know that I am not a detail-oriented person unless it involves solving a really nuanced problem. Outside of that, I don't want to get involved in the details at all. So maybe having somebody that has a background that's like a CPA or that's an auditor or someone else that has that skill set, what an incredible benefit to the program and that I can build in and recognizing that's something that, again, the diversity of thought and perspective that can build up the team.
You want to have this, the sum be greater than the part, shall we say. You need all the different parts. I'll think back to much earlier in my career when I was building out a team, and I hired somebody who had 30 years more experience than I did in the industry, was a former chief compliance officer. I was in a mid to low level management role, and I hired them with all this experience, and people were questioning, why are you hiring that person? They're going to want your job. And I said, well, first of all, they've agreed to join my team as an individual contributor. If they want my job and they're better at it, so be it. I'll do something else. I said, but from my standpoint, they've been there and done that. And they know more than I do in certain areas because I'm looking for certain subject matters. And they have deep expertise. Why wouldn't I hire somebody that I can learn from who knows more than I do? And that would make the team better. And I guess you call that a low ego approach sometimes. I don't know that I'm accused of having a low ego, but at least from a hiring perspective, I do want people that know more than I do, know different things than I do, and bring something new to the firm. There's a benefit to having the mix, Patrick. And to your point, it's also critical to realize in what don't you know? As you said, maybe there are some details. I know you focus on legal details. You're a great lawyer, but maybe there's other areas not so much. I know there are certain things I'm not as good at as other things, and that's where you want to have people come in who can bring that to the table and challenge you in many ways in a respectful way and challenge their teammates.
That's such a smart take. It really is. And I completely agree down the line with why there is at least a certain level of humility that I think is inherent in, again, like the good leadership of what you're doing for the team and recognizing how you can have the sum of the parts be far greater, right, than each individual, and allowing that to take place organically as you're building out the team and recognizing what some of those strengths are. I really like how you frame that. So one other question I guess I would have then, though, is you're thinking about, okay, I've got these different candidates potentially that I'm looking at, and I'm thinking about building out the team. They're bringing with them their own set of unique circumstances and experiences and technical expertise that is ultimately going to be beneficial. Are you also thinking about, when you're bringing them in, some of the business constituents, I guess I'd say, or like how they might be ultimately going to be able to plug into the firm and fit into the firm? And are you taking some of that into consideration, or maybe a better way to frame that is, how are you taking that into consideration as you're thinking about their potential role inside the firm?
Yeah, that's the phrase people use, fit. Are they a fit, shall we say? But you do need to have a recognition of what the firm is like and with whom they're going to be dealing. If you are bringing somebody into I'm going to stereotype a bit for firms, but a trading firm, it's your folks are going to be moving fast, thinking quickly. You'll probably have people sitting on the trading desk, virtual or otherwise. They're going to have to give answers quickly. They're going to have to jump in fast on stuff. They're going to have to weigh in and sometimes slow things down or shut things down quickly. That takes a different sort of mindset and approach than if you're at a firm that is in a business line that develops, where it might be, I'll use investment banking as an example, where things are happening sometimes over weeks or months or years for a deal to develop. And yes, you might need to act really quickly during that last 24 to 48 hours as you're getting to the deal pitch or the close or this or that, but there's a little more time to develop the issue. So some of it is that perspective. Some of it is, do you have people at your firm? Is this an old line financial firm where everyone's been there or been in the industry 20, 30, 35 years? Or are you at a technology company? It's going to have different perspectives. A tech focused company, myself, mine, and a number of other firms, where many of the folks might not be coming from a financial services background. You need to adapt your approach. So when you're looking for compliance folks, are they flexible in how they talk? Can they describe things a little differently? Can they move away from assumed regulatory knowledge to provide regulatory knowledge to people who are really sharp and probably know a lot more about building things out than some others might, but they need the regulatory piece? So you've got to really adapt it from that perspective. And that's before you even get to, is it a firm where they appreciate direct conversations versus a firm that wants something that's a little softer and less direct? So it's really getting the antenna, or maybe it's more like sailing. The firm's got a certain way they do things, and you've got to bring people in to do it that way. It's not compromising your compliance approach. It's not compromising the knowledge. It's the soft skills. Which ones do you need?
Yeah. Yeah. What I like about how you describe it, and you used a little bit there talking about the kind of sailing analogy, another one that I might throw out there, and that I think even speaks to a lot of what you've talked about today and kind of building out the team, is some of the best coaches in any sport, they have principles that they like to use as the foundation, but then they will fit their scheme based on the talent of the team, of the players that they have. And they're not locked into a quote unquote a system approach on everything, where they're going to try to force round pegs into square holes or whatever the case might be, but rather the coach is going to be adaptive, right? And they're certainly going to have those core principles, which, like to your point, is like, we're not going to bend on the core principles of our compliance program, but ultimately we have really talented individuals. So I'm going to want to think about, again, the fit and how they're going to come into the firm and how we might be able to maximize their talents in working with the teams inside my firm.
That's well said. The coaching analogy is a good one, because sometimes you didn't get to put the team together. Sometimes you inherit the team, you moved into a new firm or a new role, and you have the team you have, and you do go with your core principles. I mean, I've got 10 thoughts that I always talk about. I'm not going to bore you with them now, but I think about those as my principles for people in compliance and programs, but you got to go with who you have. And sometimes you might have Meryl Streep. I'll go to an acting as on your team. You might have Joaquin Phoenix or somebody like that. Those are going to be, you can do a lot of different things there. In some cases, I won't shame an actor or actress, but you might have somebody who they're just really good only at action films, whatever that is, and you're not giving them nuance and dialogue. And if you don't have an action movie, you may not be able to use them at that moment. And that's sometimes how you have to think of it, Patrick.
I love the analogies that we're using on today's show. And man, between the coffee and compliance and stuff that we talked about at the beginning, and now we're bringing in some other actors like Meryl Streep and Joaquin Phoenix, we're going to make a really great spinoff, I feel like, Norm.
Yes, Patrick. And look, what I'll say is, much of what we do, especially as you get further in your career, is storytelling. We have to tell the story of compliance. We have to sell it, and we have to tell it. And depending on what your firm's culture is and where it is in its development and the like, at a certain point, you do need people who don't just know the rules and haven't memorized them. If you're sitting down with the head of whatever business or a product developer, I don't know that they care that the rule is called XYZ.422.26 and it's from 1923. I don't think they care. They do care to say, hey, what things are you telling me that I can't do the way I want to do them or say them, want to say them? And how can you work with me to say them properly? And that's, if you can't tell that story in a way they understand it, then you may not succeed at many firms. And that's why, I use a lot of analogies. Sometimes they're not great, but they kind of work because you're trying to make it approachable, Patrick.
I really like the analogies. And I think the point that you drive home there about how they can be really impactful or meaningful as you're recruiting and also potentially building out the folks on your compliance team and why that's important. I think you've done a great job of kind of articulating that there. It actually, the storytelling part leads me to another question that gets a little bit more, I'll say, granular into the process of recruiting potentially or hiring, and when you're looking to enhance your compliance team. But as you're thinking about the interviewing process, I'll even say, like, at that granular level, when you're thinking about some of the strategies and the stuff that you use when you're going through that and finding the right person, are you typically, like, do you yourself have like a bank of questions that you like to ask candidates? Do you frequently ask them to do a little bit of storytelling, maybe of like why they're looking to come into compliance, or if they've been in compliance, how they got there and why they're interested in the role now? I would just love to hear some of your thoughts on some of the strategies you like to use when you're doing some of the interviewing.
Yeah. So interviewing is clearly important. Once you've got folks that you've determined might be qualified for the role, you want to speak with them. And one of the things that we do here at Robinhood, at least, is have, you use the word banks. We often have question banks. I have some in my head, but I've been asked to put them down on paper, which is actually a helpful exercise. And then when you build out for the interviews, you build out your diverse slate of interviewers to make sure you've got business partners, you've got oversight partners. You don't have everybody sitting in front of them look just like you when you're doing the interviews. Reflect the firm and give them topics, give them subject areas, give them what to test on. And yes, you're going to have some sample questions. Sometimes it's going to be hypotheticals. I love giving candidates hypotheticals, and I'm not looking to get a right answer per se. It's not about that. It's about understanding, how do they think about whatever that is? And it's not going to be hypothetical about if you're the captain of a ship. It's going to be something, I've gotten those questions. It's more the kinds that are relate to the job. If you know you're in a certain situation, give them a situational question that might be based in part on truth or on a regulatory thing, and see how they think through, see how they approach it, see how they get to an answer, whatever it might be. And that is one way to get through that. And then I think critically, make sure when you're thinking about how did they perform in the interview? And when you have that from all the other interviewers, that you're anchoring things to things they said that are relevant to the job and that are factual, not, I like the way they answered that. They seem like a good person. Those are not great things. They seem smart. Why did they seem smart? Give an example. And I have to force myself as well to say, okay, yes, we had a great conversation and that can help because I can see, can they relate to a business partner well because they can meet you and relate well. But some of it is, why was it a good conversation? Was it the energy they had? Was it that they reacted to the way you asked the questions and riffed on that? Did it have a good flow back and forth like I hope we have right now, Patrick? Like, have some whys, and that's how I think about that. And the banks are helpful because then you can draw on questions and not start from scratch every time you're hiring.
I really like that idea of having kind of a question bank or something that, again, even though, and to your point, you've done lots and lots of interviews over the years, but even still, when you're in the middle of an interview, it might be helpful just to have a reference, right, that you can look at to see if you've covered some of the types of questions or you've been able to receive from the interviewee the kinds of meaningful feedback that you would look for to understand, as you described, like how they think in certain situations and how they might react in certain situations. That is super, super telling. I can tell you, that was something I wish that I would have thought about more or understood better earlier in my career, understanding how the team dynamic and what you're building, whether it's StrengthsFinder or the Enneagram or lots of other things that you can do to better understand how your people are built and what drives them, what motivates them, the kinds of things that they find appealing or curious and helps enhance the level of effort that they're willing to give. Those things are important, because ultimately they can help really lead to professional and personal fulfillment. And if you have a team of compliance professionals that you've been able to build this kind of infrastructure that leads to professional and personal fulfillment, I think you're really going to get the most out of that team when it comes to running the program.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to test is the right word, I think, for what is their motivation for wanting to join? I mean, some people, yes, they just need a job, but do they really want a job at your company or your law firm or your agency? If you're hiring in the government, it's easy to say, yes, I've always been interested in the widget making process. Great. Why? What led to that interest? Talk to me about what excites you about it. What is that? And you have to keep in mind that we all spend a lot of time at work. Some people 8 hours, some people 12 or 16, whatever it is. You're spending a lot of time with these folks, sometimes more than your family, sadly. They have to actually be able to interact with each other in a way that's productive. And maybe they're not going to be best of friends, but they've got to actually be able to work effectively, efficiently, and passionately for whatever your company and your department are trying to accomplish. So yeah, you've got to get a little bit of that. And again, this whole fit thing can be fraught with peril if not done properly. Not everyone should be just happy jokesters. You know, some people are introverts, some are extroverts, but it's really, is everybody rowing in the same direction? Even if everyone's got different music in their headphones is another analogy I'll use.
I like that. Let's stay on one of the things you touched on there, and certainly building a compliance team is going to have certain challenges and risks and other stuff that might be present. If you're thinking about in a very broad sense, what are some of the key areas or things that you might want to be on the lookout for? What are some key considerations or areas of risk that you're thinking about when you're building out your compliance team, or even, I guess I'll add, building out your compliance team or delegating kind of responsibility inside of the compliance program?
So I think as you're building the team, or as I'm building the team, it's me, I certainly want to keep an eye on, we talked a lot about the interview process, but certainly want to keep an eye on who on the team is out for themselves, as opposed to who's out for improving the program or the firm, who's out to better themselves at the expense of others. Because I'm all for people wanting to do more, to take on larger, more complex things and the like, but I don't want to see them doing that by taking it from somebody else. Those are watch areas. Certainly watch areas of some of it's even in how you conduct a meeting, Patrick. It's not directly in your question, but I will sometimes reach out and, you know, identify the person who's been silent and say, what do you think here? Or do you disagree? Sometimes we're on video. I can read the face and see there's something going on back there if you know the team. But, you know, those, because you can have the people who dominate. And if you have a risk, if you've got a group of people, talented compliance people, all of whom are high achievers, all of whom are type A personalities, all of whom are extroverts, that's a watch area. It's great in many ways, but at a certain point, you wonder who's going to work all the time, roll up their sleeves and wallow in the details. Who's going to be thoughtful and reactive and listening to the others? Or are they all trying to show themselves to be great to me or the business partner or to my manager, whoever that might be? And those are some of the things I think about, Patrick. Certainly, at a basic level, do you relate well to the other oversight partners and business partners? Are you somebody who manages up but does not treat your peers well or others? And we've all run into these people, and I'm trying to keep an eye out for that as well, to say, this is not about me. This is about what you're doing as a team. Or if I get feedback from a skip level that somebody isn't present, if it's a manager, that's something I keep an eye out as well, Patrick. I mean, it's not easy to do these things, but those are things you have to keep an eye on. Again, if you've got a small team, it's even more stark when you've got that problem. If you've got a larger team, it can be harder to spot, but can easily spread if you've got those negative behaviors. So I think that's what you were getting at.
Yeah, no, you hit the nail on the head. Those are all really excellent considerations that I think if you are in the kind of position that you're in, where you're building out your compliance team and you're having to think about, you know, how, again, firms evolve, right? They're not static entities. And just like firms evolve, your compliance program and the people that are driving the compliance program are going to have to continue to adapt and evolve as well. And I also really liked how you talked about sometimes, again, just because of a personality type, you might have someone who in a room full of lots of other compliance personnel may not be the most forward when it comes to speaking. But sometimes those people are the most reflective and introspective in the way that's going to be really helpful, because they're thinking about that problem in a very different way than the people who might be talking the most. And so that's super, super helpful to make sure that you're hearing that voice, right? I mean, just even back to the diversity of thought and perspective and experiences that is so important, critically important when you're building out your team. I think that's another example of that, where I want to make sure we as compliance officers want to make sure that voice also gets heard in the room.
Yeah, and sometimes it doesn't have to be heard in the room either, Patrick. It could be afterwards. If you're talking or you're getting ready to talk, you may not be listening because you're thinking of what you're going to say next and you're not reflecting.
Yeah.
I'm doing as I'm listening to you. I don't know.
No, that's exactly right. And I know you're absolutely right. So sometimes even back to the coaching analogy, right? Sometimes rather than pulling that person out and forcing them to do something in front of the whole team, but rather doing that in a more closed environment with that one player to talk about what they're thinking about or how they're viewing a certain situation, can be really beneficial. Norm, this has been an incredible conversation. I am so appreciative of you taking the time to talk through a lot of these really important items and considerations for firms that are going to be, that are either currently building out their compliance team or looking to do that in the future, in that Certainly for all firms, no matter what size, building that culture of compliance inside the firm and being viewed and seen as a real strategic partner with the business units and the investment professionals inside the firms is so important. And so thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
No, I appreciate the time, Patrick. And if I could leave like three thoughts for folks.
Would love that. Yes, order. Please. Yes.
One, and something I've said for years, is that our role in compliance, you can look at it as enabling safe growth. That's that's the phrase that I use. If we say no to everything, if we don't work with the business, then the business doesn't grow. And if it doesn't grow, there's no business. And the customers don't get the services you might be providing, which might be unique. So we enable safe growth. I think secondly, make the complex simple. It's a phrase I learned from a manager 15 plus years ago. If you speak in jargon all the time, if you're not able to break things down in a way that people understand, then you're not going to be understood and things are not going to be done right. I think thirdly, you touched on this earlier, Patrick, which is be curious. Look outside your industry, ask questions, learn things, read everything, because compliance is ever changing. And if you're not curious and if you're not learning, then you're probably not going to succeed and you're probably in the wrong profession. So that's what I would leave folks with. In addition, love the podcast and I appreciate you doing this and spreading the compliance knowledge.
Well, thank you for that last bit. But no, I would say, I mean, what you just articulated there is very sage advice. And certainly for all of our listeners, they would definitely benefit to hear that and start to even execute and implement a lot of that inside of their own firms. I am so appreciative of you coming on the pod today to chat. I will, if you'll humor me, I will. We're done with all the technical, the hard-hitting questions on today's podcast, but maybe we'll close up shop today with something a little bit more fun. So we are certainly at the end of the year and nearing the holiday season here. So my question for you to cap off today's conversation is, what is your most favorite dessert that you're looking forward to, or treat, we'll call it dessert or treat, that you're looking to get into during this holiday season?
I don't think it's holiday season specific, but I frankly love a good chocolate mousse.
Ooh,
and I think nice. That's good for any season. A well-made, fluffy, but not too dense, little bit of homemade whipped cream dropped on top of the mousse. Maybe that's sacrilegious, but the mousse and just the right, not too cold, not too hot, just the right temperature with the right chocolatey flavor. That would be my go-to, Patrick. So if you want to ship me some, I'll be glad.
Yeah, I was just about to say, that sounds like a perfect thank you.
Maybe that's why I focused on the woman with the candy store.
Exactly. You already had me thinking about it even before we got to the end.
What's yours, Patrick?
What's my favorite? And this is definitely not something that I really like outside of kind of the colder weather months, I'll say. But I do really like some of the like peppermint bark and the other stuff that you can pair. And I actually had some recently that was like a chocolate and peanut butter pretzel with a little bit of mint peppermint bark. It was very good. I was not expecting it to be good, but the lovely and talented Sarah Hayes got it and told me that I should try it. And she was dead on right. It was delicious.
It sounds delicious to me. If you like peanut butter, it sounds delicious.
Yeah. Norm, thank you again so much. Really appreciate you coming on the show and looking forward to maybe having you back on the podcast here at some point down the road.
Glad to rejoin, Patrick. And I hope you and the family enjoy the holidays. Thanks.
Thanks, you too. The final part of today's show features another segment of What's On My Mind. As a quick reminder for some of our new listeners, this segment represents a tip of the cap to all those editorial artists from years past and will often include a unique perspective or nuanced take and highlight how it relates to the investment management industry and our securities compliance family. In today's What's On My Mind, we look at an old quote inspired by Winnie the Pooh. In the Disney home video, Sing a Song with Pooh Bear, there is an exchange with Pooh Bear and Piglet that goes a little something like this. "Today was a difficult day," said Pooh. There was a pause. "Do you want to talk about it?" asked Piglet. "No," said Pooh after a bit. "No, I don't think I do." "That's okay," said Piglet. And he came and sat beside his friend. "What are you doing?" asked Pooh. "Nothing really," said Piglet. "Only I know what difficult days are like. I quite often don't feel like talking about it on my difficult days either." "But goodness," continued Piglet, "difficult days are so much easier when you know you've got someone there for you. And I'll always be here for you, Pooh." And as Pooh sat there, working through in his head his difficult day, while the solid, reliable Piglet sat next to him quietly, swinging his little legs, he thought that his best friend had never been more right. While the holidays can bring with it great joy and an excess of love and positive emotions for some, that's not the case for everyone. And earlier in the show, we got to hear some fantastic advice on what it takes to build out and be a part of a compliance team. And so this year, while you're spending time with loved ones and friends, be sure to pick up the phone or send a message to others on your compliance team or anyone inside your firm for that matter, and be inclusive of all of those that might be in your circle, from loved ones and friends to colleagues and team members. As I tell my daughters all the time, it doesn't cost anything to be nice. And you never know how powerful and positive an impact you can make just by letting someone else know you're there for them if they need you to be. And that will do it for today's show. I'd like to thank our sponsors, CALFI and the National Society of Compliance Professionals, and extend a big thank you to our guest, Norm Ashkenas, for coming on the show to discuss how firms can build a culture of compliance inside their firm and what it takes to build out an effective compliance team. Please join us again next time on the Securities Compliance Podcast, where we help you put compliance in context. Please check us out on LinkedIn. You can search for Compliance in Context Podcast, or on X using the handle @CompliancePod. You can like us and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or go to ComplianceInContextPodcast.com to listen and learn more.